have four licensure bills today, and we're going to start with you, Senator Dibble. Senate File 685, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 685. Thank you very much. I just have the original draft. Is a bill that would set up a licensing scheme for respiratory therapists. Mr. Chair and members, as you're probably very familiar, respiratory therapy has long since moved out of hospitals where it originated with the big machines of the early days, and has moved out into many, many settings, including home settings, and has become a fairly common device that's used, or set of devices that are used for a very, very wide variety of conditions and diseases. Mr. Chair, members, respiratory therapists do carry out their profession and their practice under the supervision of a doctor, but they're operating an extremely vital service for folks who are often in very critical conditions. Occasionally, they have to make very quick decisions. Sometimes those decisions are life-sustaning, which really emphasizes the need to make sure that there's adequate training and assurance of qualifications. As you're probably familiar, having dealt with many, many licensing and licensure bills, why should we license this particular profession? And I think the answer is fairly self-evident. We need a system that assures some standard of education and competency, especially now, as I said earlier, that the practice is so much less site-specific. Presently in Minnesota, there really are no mandated minimums of education or experience or competency. Folks can call themselves respiratory therapists. They can work in a whole variety of settings and provide a whole array of services just if they're directed to by their employer. And that has led to some real problems and some real crises of care. I'll call your attention to this handout, which is an article in the newspaper that outlines in some detail some of the very, very serious problems that happened a few years ago at a for-profit hospital in which folks not qualified for providing respiratory therapy. Very, very quickly, Mr. Chair, the licensure standards would make sure that only those folks calling themselves a licensed respiratory therapist have graduated from an accredited program and have passed a valid competency exam, and of course provides for ongoing demonstrations of competency and continuing education. It provides that critical control and monitoring mechanism, gives a means of barring those folks who have been disqualified from other states. And as I'm mentioning other states, I should make note that we are the only state in the lower 48 that doesn't require licensure for respiratory therapists. The only other two states that don't have the same requirement, and one of them is actually moving on this, are Alaska and Hawaii. I think it's Alaska.
Hawaii.
Or Hawaii. Hawaii is starting to take a look at establishing licensing standards. This does not reach into the scope of practice for other healthcare practitioners, those who are qualified to provide respiratory therapy as a matter of their scope of practice, can continue to do so. And this has a concern that's often raised is to have an effect on salaries. In studies on that question, this has had no effect on salaries for those who do gain licensure status. With that, Mr. Chair, you know, very quickly, we can take a quick high-level overview of the bill. And we're waiting for
we do have the A3 amendment in the packets. Senator Prettner Solon moves the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author requests.
Mr. Chair, I just need to confirm with counsel if that's the right.
She just handed me that a minute ago.
Okay.
A3, yes. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair and members, the first section just tightens up definitions, make sure that we're talking about licensure, talks about the credentialing exam. Thank you very much. The credentialing examination that folks need to adhere to. Section 2 covers the scope of practice, kind of the guts of the bill, what exactly licensed respiratory therapists are qualified to do, quite specifically. Section 3 is replaced in the amendment. So you can take a look at the amendment. And this, of course, prohibits those who are not licensed from engaging in those activities that are defined in the scope of practice, and also is very specific about who can call themselves a respiratory therapist. And this is also where we really get to that issue of folks in other professions who are already qualified to do this can in fact remain doing that. And I'll also just continue to emphasize that nothing really changes fundamentally with respiratory therapists. They remain under the direction of under the supervision of physicians. Section 4 are the licensure requirements. These are the standards, the testing standards to which folks need to adhere. That's an education standard and a credential that's issued by the National Board for Respiratory Care. Deals with the reciprocity questions as well. And has some administrative technical items around the temporary registration pieces. And then remaining, there are also some other language changes and the like. Section 5 just deals with some of the administrative details on administering the licensure regimen. Section 6, the continuing education requirements. And then Section 7, 8, are just some language cleanups recognizing this new status of licensure. I did speak with Bill Auld at the Board of Medical Practice on Friday. He can't be here today. He's dealing with something related to his family. But though the Board of Medical Practice doesn't take a position, they're neutral. He did emphasize to me that he feels like this might give them a better handle on dealing with some of the complaints that have come forward in the past with substandard care, which they have no ability to act on at this time. This relates to the article that I showed you earlier. It does not adversely affect their ability to administer what they need to do with respect to this profession. It's totally cost neutral. There will be no fiscal note. He's very comfortable with this bill, as is. With that, Mr. Chair, we have some folks who would like to also share with you why this is a good idea. We'll start with Shelley Klein, who's the president of the Minnesota Society of Respiratory Care Therapists.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Shelley Klein. I'm the president for the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care, and I wanted to thank you all for hearing our important bill today. I have been a respiratory therapist in the state of Minnesota most of the time in the state of Minnesota for 28 years. I've been a respiratory therapist for 28 years. Our people that are testifying today are Carrie Barassa. She's our co-chair for our legislative committee, and also Alex Adams, who is our representative on the Respiratory Care Advisory Council of the Board of Medical Practice.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear our, as she said, very important move we would like to make the move from registration to licensure. For the record, my name is Carrie Barassa. I've been a respiratory care practitioner for about 15 years and am the co-chair for the Minnesota Society for the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care. And the purpose of our proposed legislative changes is to make the transition from mere registration to licensure. The benefits are many, which have been provided for you in the top 10 list of reasons. Our main concern is public safety and the regulation of respiratory therapists working in Minnesota without being regulated by the Board of Medical Practice because they have circumvented the title RCP. With registration, this is title protection only, and within Minnesota being the last of the lower 48 states, we are concerned that Minnesota could potentially become a magnet for those RTs who have been reprimanded and or had their license withdrawn in other states. Currently, legislation has been introduced even in Hawaii, and the licensure as well. The efforts in Alaska are occurring as we speak. There have already been deaths in Minnesota that have already been mentioned as a result of this issue. We want all people under the respiratory care scope of practice to be required to be licensed by the Board of Medical Practice. There are individuals whom, may have taken a national examination and passed it, but have not become regulated in Minnesota under the current conditions. Therefore, these individuals have not been required to demonstrate the needed continuing education, nor possibly background checks to see if their license was affected in other states. We believe this to be a serious patient safety issue. We are not looking to change our scope of practice nor the scope of practice of other healthcare practitioners. We have many things as healthcare practitioners that overlap what we do to make the patients we serve as healthy as they can be with a multidisciplinary approach. As listed in the top 10 reasons to license, this does not increase costs, as generally it is the location and the education level that drive the wages, which have been shown across the country. This should not cause limitations in the jobs of RTs, as the process of moving from registration to licensure should remain the same or largely the same through the Board of Medical Practice. In this economy, in reality, no one is getting raises, and layoffs are indeed occurring in Minnesota for respiratory therapists. I, for the first time in 20 years, have had to look outside of Minnesota for a job as a respiratory therapist. I found wages to be either comparable to or, in many cases, less than the current wages in Minnesota. The last study done, an Arthur study, showed no evidence of wage increase due to licensure. Again, we wish to maintain the safety of the patients we treat by requiring all who practice under the credentials of a respiratory therapist to be licensed in the great state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time and consideration on behalf of the patients that we serve. Please help us bring Minnesota into alignment with the rest of the contiguous 47 states with licensure of RTs to assure our patient safety and not potentially become a magnet for those who have lost the ability to practice in other states. And thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moress. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Not Mr. Adams.
Hi, I'm Alexander Adams. I'm a respiratory therapist. I have been one for 39 years, and I want to thank Senator Dibble for sponsoring this bill that would convert our registration status to licensure. This is a serious patient care safety issue, and I'd like to make two major points about why it's important that this becomes legislation. As registered respiratory therapists, we are regulated, but it's inadequate. This bill is not brand new. It's a conversion because the registration system is, in effect, I'm not going to say falling apart, but the article that was cited is serious. There were deaths related to unregulated respiratory therapists who were evading the system. And now that was several years ago, but now we're faced with on the Respiratory Care Advisory Council, as part of the Board of Medical Practice, 7 complaints within the last 2 years of practitioners who are clearly evading the system. People who are within a regulatory system are monitored for continuing education, competence, drug and alcohol abuse problems, boundary problems. There are individuals not within the system that can all be happening, and the citizens of Minnesota are not protected by the care they're providing. This bill would clean that up. It would see that everybody practicing respiratory care would require a license. These cases have been people that are either in direct violation, and there have been stipulations and orders that they've needed to pay fines to come into line to the current system. There have been those that continue to flagrantly practice under the title RRT and CRT, which is a trademarked title that's a national title, but it's not it's recognized in Minnesota. Hospitals can employ those people, but they then cannot be brought into the regulatory system. We have a complaint we're dealing with right now of a person who's an aide, who appears to be practicing respiratory care. And when questioned last week at our Board of Medical Practice subcommittee meeting, I asked Assistant Attorney General Steve Mastin if this was one of the reasons why we should be licensed, and his answer was yes. People that represent the Attorney General's office and who are part of the Board of Medical Practice have been equally frustrated with this serious situation. The remedy would be this bill. The conversion from registration to licensure should be seamless. The issues that Carrie cited can be supported, and I would urge you to vote for this proposal for legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe for counsel, I'm just curious about statute 214-002 apply in the case of this bill?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
While she's looking at that, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I just wanted to offer a comment and commend all of the various stakeholders that have been working on this particular issue. I think that it is good work. It's warranted. And I know that there's been a great deal of thought put into the language that appears before us today, and I'm very appreciative of the work that has been done on this. So thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Lynch. As long as we're mutually admiring each other, I know you put in some time helping bring the stakeholders together over the weekend. So I appreciate your time and effort and your stakeholders who have shown very good faith.
Senator Counselor, did you want to comment on Senator Hand's question?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, it looks like it would apply, but there isn't anything in the statute that says if it isn't followed, what happens?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, and so I guess that's my question. I've had actually inquiries from folks who have had a number of bills this session that deal with licensing in different forms, and people have asked me whether this provision has any effect, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to ask the question. And my reading through it, you're right, there's no provision for it if it isn't followed, but does that mean we should disregard it, or should we not expect that? I mean, what it's calling for essentially is some information to be provided anytime you do a change in regulation status. And I think the information they're asking for is pertinent to any decision like this, and I don't know why we wouldn't want to have it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, apparently they have filed this report, and it is in your packet, so
all right,
they have
you.
Complied. So,
I did not see that in the packet.
Is there anyone in the audience who wish to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there any discussion from members of the committee? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and either for the author or anyone who's here from the Department of Health, will this increase the funding needs of this licensure program? Board of Medical Practice. Someone here.
Mr. Chair, I did speak with Mr. Auld from the Board of Medical Practice on Friday. And it was his opinion that this would not affect their ability to administer. There'd be no fiscal effect at all.
Thank you.
No cost.
Senator Torres Rey moves that Senate File 685 as amended be recommended to pass, and I don't think any other, it goes to the floor. On Senator Torres Rey's motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you very much.
Senate File 999, Senator Kubley. Welcome to the committee, Senate File 999.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 999 deals with a topic that was before the committee last year, and, you know, at that time, you know, there were a number of groups that had some opposing comments. And as I recall, it was laid on the table, Mr. Chair, and you know, we've been working on it pretty steadily. I guess from my perspective as an individual, you know, I worked in a clinical lab for a period of time, but then a number of years ago when I moved to Granite Falls, I was visiting the lab at the hospital there. And the lab director asked me if I could identify, you know, I mentioned to him that I had worked in a lab, and he asked me if I could identify the cell on the slide, and it had a couple of nucleated reds under the microscope, and I told him what they were, and he nodded and put another slide under there, and they were immature forms of white cells, and you know, he offered me a job at that point. And I thought, well, you know, as I left there, I thought, gosh, you know, you're being offered a job for something that you haven't done for 15 years. You know, at that point, I really didn't feel qualified to do much of anything, even though I suppose I would have been under the tutelage of some people who knew what they were doing. But, you know, part of that experience, as I reflected on it, has led me to feel that we need some form of licensure for people who do work there, you know. And, you know, I guess I'm not really interested in working in a lab. I wanted a job that really had more contact with people. But I think because of that earlier introduction, Mr. Chair and members, you know, last year, the College of American Pathologists and the Minnesota Society for Pathology, as well as the Mayo Clinic, were all testifying in opposition to this legislation. But since then, the College of American Pathologists reversed their opposition late last year, and the licensure coalition has worked pretty closely with the Minnesota Society for Pathology and the Mayo Clinic to modify the bill to make changes that they felt they could live with. At this point, both of those groups are officially neutral on the bill and have stated that they do not plan to oppose it officially. But if I could take just a minute, Mr. Chair, to compare this year's bill with last year's, the following changes have been made. First off, a number of clinical lab occupations that fall under the broader categories of cytology and histology have all been exempted from this bill. Then a requirement for the certification of medical assistants who are performing lab tests of moderate complexity has been added. A distinction has also been made between independent technical judgment as practiced by lab professionals and independent medical judgment as practiced by physicians. In addition, the subspecialty category for fairly complex laboratories, such as those represented by the Mayo Clinic, has been placed in the bill, and it also provides for some flexibility for future changes in the profession. I think the bill this year does affirm the federal CLIA regulations as kind of a basement floor, if you will, a standard below which no laboratory professionals would want to work under, and that they do work under the direction of a director. And finally, Mr. Chair and members, the composition of the council, the advisory council, has been changed from 11 people to 9, but includes 3 pathologists. And with that, Mr. Chair, we have a number of people who would like to speak, and we'll turn it over to Mr. Panning, and he can take it from here.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Panning.
Chairman and members of the committee, our first speaker today will be Kathy Hansen, who is the Operations Director of Labs at the University of Minnesota Medical Center in Fairview.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'll give a high-level overview of the bill and then turn it over to my colleagues here at the table with me. Kathy Hansen, co-chair of the Licensure Coalition that has encompassed 10 professional societies and stakeholders in the preparation of this bill. As we heard the last group mention, in healthcare today, the focus is really on quality and patient safety. And in all healthcare professions, the foundation for quality and patient safety relates to the level of preparedness and competency of the personnel doing the work. This applies to physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, and it needs to apply to those professionals performing laboratory tests. You've heard CLIA mentioned already. That's the federal standards that are really far below the way laboratory medicine is practiced in Minnesota. In testimony to Congress in 2006, Dr. Dennis O'Leary, who was president of the Joint Commission at that time, stated, "The Joint Commission believes that the personnel standards required by CLIA are insufficient to adequately protect patients and the public health." Over 70% of the objective data used in medical decision-making comes from the laboratory. Despite some people's perception, the laboratory is not a black box where results happen only because of technology. There are many types of testing performed, all the way from your routine cholesterols and your analyses on up to very complex cross-matching and molecular testing. Properly educated and trained professionals are required for this. So the purposes of our licensure bill are to ensure quality and patient safety, to gather data on the laboratory workforce in this state for emergency preparedness and workforce planning, and to define the scope of practice of this already well-recognized healthcare profession. The bill defines routes to getting a license, which include what educational preparation or degree are required, the clinical experience, and successful completion of a nationally recognized certification exam. In Section 8, the bill defines one license at the associate degree level and 4 types of licenses at the baccalaureate degree level, which reflects the complexity of the work that's done in the laboratory. Provision is also required as Senator Kubley mentioned, for a subspecialty license not requiring a certification exam, but requiring competency validation by the laboratory director for the very subspecialized work done in some of the laboratories at the Mayo Clinic and possibly some of the other larger laboratories in the state. In Section 10, the bill contains provisions for a temporary license, allowing an individual to work under supervision while they get the experience needed to become certified. I've been asked about the impact of this on some of the smaller facilities around the state, and one of the reasons that temporary provision is in there is to allow for folks to take some of the online courses that are now available to actually become certified. There is a grandfather position, of course, in Section 7, which is included to grant a license to people who are currently working in the field, even if they don't meet the requirements that the bill would require going forward. A provision is also included in Section 2 under exemptions to recognize the needs, again, of some of the small labs, often rural, often those in physician offices, which do only the waived and moderate complexity level testing. Individuals that hold certification as a certified medical assistant are exempt from needing a license and can perform testing under the supervision of a medical laboratory scientist licensed under this act, or of an individual who qualifies as a supervisor under CLIA, which includes most physicians. Renewal of the license will require documented continuing education, which is very important in a field that changes as quickly as this one does. CE can be gained on the job and is similar to the recertification requirements of the bodies that provide the certification exams, and is also consistent with Joint Commission requirements that staff demonstrate continuing education and continuing competency. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
There is a rather technical amendment that committee council drafted for this bill, and I wonder if we should add
Senator
that
Torres
before
Ray
we
moves,
proceed.
Sure. Senator Torres Ray moves the author's A4 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, my name is Karen Renaud. I'm the lab manager at Kanabec Hospital in Mora, Minnesota. I've been a laboratorian for 23 years or more. Currently, many, if not most, laboratories in Minnesota already have hiring practices that comply with provisions of this bill, including mine. However, these requirements are voluntary and can be changed at any time. Laboratory professionals are one of the few healthcare professions not licensed in Minnesota. 12 states currently license laboratory professionals, 5 other states have introduced bills, and about 15 other states are working on bill language. The impetus comes from concern among working laboratory professionals about quality of testing and the inadequacy of the CLIA personnel standards. 10 professional organizations participated in development of the bill language, and as was stated before, the Licensure Coalition has tried very hard to involve other stakeholders, MHA, MMA, MDH, Minnesota Society for Pathology, and they've addressed concerns they have raised. Also previously stated, 3 groups that testified against this bill last year no longer oppose it. We've reached agreements with the Minnesota Pathologists, their national organization, CAP, and the Mayo Clinic, and did basically what was asked last year and worked out our differences with the opposition. In addition, MHA, as an organization, will not be opposing the bill. Regarding the supply of qualified laboratory professionals in Minnesota, there are 9 associate degree programs for medical laboratory technician generalists at the MinSCU 2-year colleges, and 3 private colleges with 5 sites either open or soon to be open. These programs can produce 100 graduates per year and have nearly full enrollments. At present, there are 3 accredited baccalaureate-level programs for medical laboratory science generalists. In Minnesota, the number of programs training 4-year clinical laboratory professionals has been increased with the opening of new programs at Fairview, Winona State University, and forthcoming programs from St. Cloud State University and the Mayo Clinic, which has 20 students. In addition, the University of Minnesota program is being expanded in Rochester and Winona, and by the fall of 2009 will be at 93 students. Current statewide capacity for educating these professionals will increase from the current 56 to approximately 150 to 200 over the course of the next few years. In addition, there are multiple online programs available to complete this education and be eligible for certification and thus licensure. Professionals working in Mora with me are all certified, and we have a mixture of education and various routes used to be eligible for that certification. We all meet the requirements for licensure in this bill, as that is what my expectation has been in hiring. Under the CLIA standards, much of the testing we do could be done by people with less education and training. But in our small, rural setting, one person is working alone in the lab 12 hours a day. I need staff with the additional training, experience, and critical thinking skills their certification helps to ensure in order to guarantee quality test results and the ability to deal with the unexpected that's sure to come up. I want this bill passed so when I'm no longer the one hiring, I have the assurance and confidence that the person doing lab work on my family and friends is licensed to do so. I was at my hairdresser last week, and when she asked if there was anything special that prompted my visit, I explained I was coming here today and why. She was surprised, as most everyone is, that the people doing your lab testing are not certified, are not licensed. And as I was thinking of our conversation later, I realized I was jealous of her license hanging on the wall and how much I'd want that for myself and my profession. The license for her profession helps protect the health and safety of the millions of Minnesotans that get haircuts every year. Why would we not want that same for the same protection for the billions of laboratory tests every year? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Renaud. Do you have any further witnesses? Oh, Mr. Panning.
So in closing, my name is Rick Panning. I'm the other chair of the Minnesota Licensure Coalition, and I am the vice president of laboratories at the Allina Health System. Dr. Kurt Hansen is a pathologist at the Mayo Clinic who last year testified against this bill in this committee, and he worked with our licensure coalition in the development of the legislation and also in the fine-tuning of it with the Mayo Clinic over the last few weeks. Dr. Hansen has often stated that the basis for quality in laboratory medicine is the people who do the work. Appropriate personnel regulations and qualifications may not answer every question, but are a necessary foundation for quality. A number of arguments have been and will be raised against this bill. The first is that we have federal regulations, they're called CLIA, that are in place. I have been in this profession as a lab manager for 26 years. As I said, one of the arguments is that we have federal regulation and therefore we don't need this. The reality is that those regulations, with the exception of one component of lab testing, cytology, are very basement level regulations. They're not at the level that any of the three of us would ever operate our labs at. For cytology, it's directly the opposite. They're very high level standards that support quality. A number of studies have been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that do document better performance on quality measures and reduction of errors when people are properly trained, educated, and certified. The Veterans Administration, which is actually exempt in this bill, has already decided that federal CLIA is not enough. They've voluntarily enacted their own nationwide personnel standards, which very much mimic what's in this bill. Some of the hospitals that will specifically lobby against this bill say that CLIA is enough. This statement to me shows first that there's a lack of awareness about the high level of testing done in our hospitals and clinics, and secondly, that if we did that, it would allow about 75% of the work we do to be done by high school graduates. My own experience has been that when you hire people with less than optimal education and training and certification, it takes longer to orient them, it takes longer for them to work independently, and ultimately, the level of judgment required takes time to develop, and there are implications for the quality of the testing. We do have a shortage. All of the healthcare professions that you're aware of have shortages, but we don't see anybody else backing away from the quality of the people that we want in those professions. We're actually at a time when most of the hospitals in our state are striving to get what's called magnet status for nursing, which requires a certain high level of education and training for nurses. There's data published by the Health Resources and Services Administration and the American Society for Pathology that shows when you compare the shortage of lab professionals in licensed versus unlicensed states, there's not very much of a difference. It's pretty much the same, and it's driven by the market. Interestingly, the growth rate in licensed states is actually greater than the growth rate in lab professionals in unlicensed states. A few years ago, we came to this committee in 2005 to save the University of Minnesota Clinical Lab Science Program, which was threatened to be closed at the time. Although that bill did not pass, your pressure on the university, backed by this profession, expanded that program from its 40 students to 93 this coming fall. It's the education and qualifications of these students that we need. And we believe in the time of a shortage, it's even more important to have the right people. One other group that will testify against this bill is the American Association of Bioanalysts. Their opposition is based on not believing that a bachelor's degree is necessary for some levels of this profession. We do believe that there are two levels to the profession, associate degree and bachelor's degree, and that that education along with certification and ongoing competency is important. There's also a belief that people might lose their jobs under this bill. Kathy already referred to the grandfathering clause. This new level of standard does apply to new practitioners. Current practitioners will be grandfathered. They also raise the concern that practitioners will leave this state to find jobs in bordering states. This has not been found to be true in any other licensed laboratory state, and we have a neighboring state in North Dakota that has had licensure since 1992, and that has not been found to be the case. The other issue that will be raised by hospitals is cost. The fact that if we pass this at this time in this state with this economic crisis, that we're raising the cost of health care. Published data, again, from the American Society for Clinical Pathology and also from the Health Resources and Service Administration does not show that licensure raises the salaries of laboratory professionals in those states that have licensure. This bill will not require funding from the general fund, and at an appropriate part of this process, there will be a fiscal note produced to determine the fees that will support this program. Finally, one other group that will oppose this bill is the cytotechs, which were removed from this bill compared to last year. They were removed as part of the compromise with the pathologists and the Mayo Clinic as primary opponents in 2008. We put them in the exempt part of this bill because CLIA regulations are very high for that part of the profession and does require them to be certified by a national certification organization. In closing, the lab is not a black box. The labs that we manage and that our people work in are not magic black boxes. Just like nursing, pharmacy, and other areas of healthcare, the work performed by this profession does require education. It does require training, certification, and ongoing competency. Not just anyone can do it. We don't just get a specimen and put it in a black box and a magic answer pops out. As the baby boomer generation ages and the need for healthcare increases, each one of you and I should be concerned about who's doing that testing. At this point, I guess I'd like to close with a statement. Why are elevated personnel standards not necessary for this profession when they are felt to be so important for the other healthcare professions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Panning. Question about why the CLIA standards for cytotechnology are strict and everything else is not. Is that because they're planning to go through fields one at a time, or?
Well, the CLIA regulations, which were passed in 1988, one of the issues that was brought to the forefront at that time had to do with the screening of pap smears in the United States and issues that were revolving around that. And so one of the real strengths of that bill and those regulations really focused on cytology and raising a lot of their standards and their certification. There was a real emphasis on the bill, and unfortunately, the rest of the lab profession was left very weak.
And you said the university program went from 40 students to 90-some now?
In the coming fall, it'll have 93 because they've expanded to multiple sites in Minnesota.
With that and the other programs, how is the shortage coming? Are we getting there?
Yeah. We're a lot further along than we used to be, and it's due to the cooperative work of the educational facilities, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and the provider organizations to make sure we do have the appropriate pipeline. If we'd have come here 5 years ago with this bill, it would have been a mistake because we wouldn't have had a pipeline to support it. We now do.
Could I just add to that the Health Education Industry Partnership has been working very hard for the last 8 years. This has representation from both the employers and the educators, and a lot of work has been done to assure that there are the appropriate clinical sites for experience for the graduates of all these programs. I think I understand that the legislature funded the HEIP originally, and it's been very, very effective in the laboratory field.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Kubley, maybe Mr. Panning or someone on other of your testifiers could respond. But Mr. Panning, in your testimony just now, talking a little bit about costs and supply of practitioners, and that's one of the questions that is in the 214 statute, but it isn't really addressed in the written document from the standpoint of what are the projected increase in cost to the system to require this? And your testimony, and I, maybe you need to clarify it for me, but I thought you were saying that there really was no impact in terms of cost to do this, which to me raises the question, then why do it at all? If there's no cost to do it, then clinics or other places would be doing it just as a matter of course, as was testified, that people want to have these higher trained individuals doing the job so that they would do it without a license requirement or otherwise. But if they're not doing it right now, presumably they're not doing it because there's some cost associated with it, and I think that that's what this question is asking, and I'd like you to explain a little bit what that cost would be.
I guess the point I was making during my testimony, first of all, was that we do not believe that this licensure bill will raise salaries of laboratory professionals in the state of Minnesota, and we have evidence to support that that hasn't happened elsewhere. The other point is that in terms of the cost impact on the state, the cost of the license will be borne by the practitioners themselves. I think the question that you're raising for me is that if there's an organization, a clinic, or a hospital that's operating at different standards now, and they need to hire at this higher level, whether, you know, wouldn't that result in an extra cost to that facility? I guess I would counter that with, because we believe so strongly in the standards and the education and the certification that's required, I believe there's a cost of quality also in terms of if things are not done properly and errors occur and quality is not delivered, there's a cost to that also.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Panning, I appreciate that. I don't doubt that. My question is really, has anybody tried to quantify that? One of the statements in your document says that that it's unacceptable to have the absence of appropriately educated people, and that if hospitals don't have the right staff, they shut the service down. And so now, if you're right that there are a large number of providers that are not using people that would qualify under this bill, and they decided not to go ahead and push that, then they would presumably shut down. And my question is that something that is realistic? Is that a cost? Is there some? It would just seem to me that it would be worth knowing what happens if you do that, if there are lots and lots of people that would suddenly say, well, I'm not doing this anymore, or I'm not going to go through this, and what kind of cost would that have to people's health care or other things? I think the 214 statute asks for those things to be considered when proposing regulation, and I'm just wondering if that has been addressed in your thinking on the bill.
You know, do we have numbers to support, you know, what's currently existing and what's not and what might be the cost of this change? I'll be very honest that we don't at this point. I guess I'd raise a situation that happened a number of years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I've often heard hospital administrators talk about when there's a nursing shortage, that's a big deal, whether it's in a small hospital or a big hospital. But what happens in reality in large hospitals, if you don't have enough nurses to take care of the patients, certain wards or parts of that hospital are closed during that time because they need a certain number of nurses to provide the care. Unfortunately, in the lab, that's never been allowed to happen, but we had a colleague in Hastings, Minnesota at that point who came to the point and couldn't fill a lab position, and the response from the hospital administrator was, the lab can't operate and the hospital can't operate if you don't have the right people. Sometimes it just takes one person not to run a lab, and you have to close it down in a small hospital, but in large facilities you can absorb that. Mm. But again, I don't have actual numbers to support for you, to be very honest.
Senator Prittner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kubley, I appreciate the work you did on this over the interim and the various perspectives that have been accommodated. I still hear one concern, and that is that in particularly small office clinics, there's often laboratory personnel who also perform as X-ray techs. And I'm just wondering about the cross-functionality of those positions and if that will still be allowed under this under these provisions.
Yes. I think I mentioned that early on, but there is a recognition in the bill, an exemption for certified medical assistants, which are the level of personnel that you're talking about, the folks in the office who do, some simple imaging procedures, some basic lab procedures and room the patients and take blood pressures and all that sort of thing. They would be required to be certified but not to hold a license because these are, you know, lesser paid folks who we didn't want to put the expense of a license on them. So these are the folks who are doing it now. They would be allowed to continue to do that under supervision under this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? If not, you want to have the opposition witnesses? Ms. Hagen? And while she's coming up, Ms. Simmerod as well. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves for the record.
I'm Shelley Simmerod. I'm representing the Minnesota Society of Cytology. And I'm Lynette Savala. I'm also representing the Minnesota Society of Cytology.
Whichever one wants to go ahead, go ahead.
Of what?
Hello, Chairman and members of the Health Policy Committee. My name is Amy Erickson-Hagen. I'm the site manager for Cryogenic Laboratories in Roseville. We are a local reproductive bank operating in the state of Minnesota since 1971. I've been at Cryogenics for 7 years, performing high-complexity testing. I have a bachelor's as well as a master's in reproductive physiology. I'm a member of the American Association of Bioanalysts, a national professional organization whose members make up clinical laboratory directors, owners, supervisors, medical technologists, laboratory technicians, and physician office laboratory technicians. I sat in front of this committee last year myself opposing this bill, and unfortunately this was the first chance that I had to speak to the members opposing the bill. First, we would like to convey our support for your efforts to enforce that the clinical laboratory workforce is properly trained and prepared to perform the important job of providing physicians, healthcare practitioners, and patients with accurate, reliable, and reproducible testing results. While I may be grandfathered in at my present job, if I were to change positions, even with my master's degree and managing my site for 7 years, I would have to go online and likely get a new another degree. We believe that SF 999 should be amended to include alternative qualification routes for MLS licensure so that individuals with an associate's degree in medical technology, individuals with 2 to 4 years of degree but not have a baccalaureate degree with a major in laboratory sciences, and individuals who have graduated from U.S. military one-year training programs for clinical laboratory personnel as would be allowed to be certified in this under this bill. This bill excludes individuals with a baccalaureate degree with a major in biology or chemistry but not medical technology. CLIA, the federal law that regulates most clinical laboratories, permits all of these individuals to perform high-complexity testing, as do a number of other states that have licensure programs. We are not opposing licensure programs, but do feel that the current bill as written is too restrictive. It's especially important to include qualification routes for these individuals because there is a shortage of clinical laboratory personnel. The shortage is only likely to increase even without this bill. The shortage is certain to increase if this bill is enacted. At present, there is only one school within Minnesota, and granted they talked that there is going to be an increase of the number of graduates. Still, clearly this four-year degree program cannot produce enough graduates to perform all of the high-complexity testing in the country. This bill requires a baccalaureate degree with no exceptions for individuals who perform high-complexity testing. This is simply too restrictive. In addition, there is an economic downturn, which is very likely to make it much more difficult for students to afford of four years of college. This will probably increase the number that opt for a two-year community college degree, unnecessarily worsening the shortage of individuals qualified to perform high-complexity testing could threaten patient access to the clinical laboratory testing in Minnesota. If a four-year degree is required to perform high-complexity testing, then many, if not all, of the technologists in smaller laboratories may have to have a four-year degree because some high-complexity testing is usually performed on all shifts. Again, I have a bachelor's degree, and I manage a site where numerous staff have a bachelor's degree. However, the bachelor's is in science, and while they would be grandfathered in, again, their jobs would be, their education would not qualify them in other areas. Another major problem with this bill is that it does not recognize examinations administered by the American Association Board of Registries. The AAB Board of Registries is recognized in all of the other state licensures, but has been excluded as recognized from this bill. We request that the bill be amended to include the AAB Board of Registries, MT and MLT certification exams. This is also the only certification exam that I would qualify to be able to take with my specialty. If a few of these issues can be addressed, we believe that other issues can be worked out. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. A copy of the testimony that I'll be giving today has been provided to you, and within that we have referenced the sections within the bill that address our concerns. It says, I would like to thank you, the committee today, for allowing our testimony regarding Senate File Bill 999, which would establish licensure for medical laboratory science professionals. We are addressing you today on behalf of the cytotechnologists of the state as representatives of the Minnesota Society of Cytology. Our message today is also supported and echoed by our fellow laboratorians in the Minnesota Society of Histotechnology. We would like to begin by reminding the committee membership that the intent of the original laboratory licensure bill, which was introduced by the coalition in 2007 but pulled before a vote in 2008, was to provide protection to the public by requiring minimum education and certification qualifications of personnel, which would ensure a high level of professional competence and to provide information about practitioners needed for emergency preparedness and workforce planning. The bill as written today is a deviation from the coalition's original mission. The language that has been added to this bill will allow non-certified individuals to perform tests that have been deemed highly complex as defined by the federal law in the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, or CLIA. Why would this be unsafe? Essentially, this bill allows individuals who do not possess a core body of knowledge as deemed necessary by nationally recognized certification agency to perform highly complex medical laboratory tests. Please keep in mind that between 70 to 90% of all medical decisions physicians render are made with the aid of laboratory test results. Do you really want a non-certified individual performing and resulting your laboratory tests, and for these non-certified individuals to be practicing independent technical judgment as defined in this bill? The coalition is now stating that an individual would be allowed to hold a license while only supplementing their education with 1 year on-the-job training experience and a letter of recommendation from the laboratory's medical director. Furthermore, this bill does not define the standardized criteria needed to ensure competency is reached as a result of the 1 year on-the-job training. In addition, the continuing education requirements defined in the bill refer back to the certification agency that certifies the individual. However, these individuals would not be certified, so how would their continuing education requirements be defined? Secondly, this bill could also be interpreted as establishing two standards for personnel licensure between hospital staff and clinic staff. By allowing the clinic laboratories to perform the same moderately complex testing without a license, that staff working in a hospital would be required to have a license to perform. Thirdly, the coalition has exempted cytotechnologists and histotechnologists from the bill to remove a potential opposition from the College of American Pathologists. Even the coalition's lobbyist, when contacted regarding the question of exempting cytotechnologists from the bill, stated in an email, December 2008 email to an MSC representative, that this may defeat the original purpose of the bill, and I quote. Collectively, these three issues work against creating a stronger and more unified laboratory workforce and will continue to further divide the medical laboratory profession while adding no value or additional safety measures to our current laboratory practices in the state. The MSC had hoped that if licensure was to become a reality in Minnesota, the law would be structured to secure the education and certification requirements needed to competently perform laboratory testing by all medical laboratory professionals. With the ever-changing technological environments of laboratory testing, we find ourselves constantly challenged with continued learning, new certifications, and revised educational programs. For example, Mayo Cytotechnology Program just announced that it will be pausing admissions for 1 year to ensure future cytotechnologists receive the educational background needed to further excel in the dynamic field of laboratory medicine. With these challenges, I asked the coalition why the bill was not structured to more easily incorporate these future undefined laboratory certifications. Our society still maintains that this bill is too rigid and complex. Our society supported a much more flexible and simple approach to ensuring the safety of laboratory testing. The current bill defines 7 medical laboratory license categories. Our proposal was to limit the bill to 2 licenses, one for medical laboratory technologist and one for medical laboratory technician. A technologist would be required to possess a baccalaureate degree, while a technician would be required to possess an associate's degree. Alongside this education, the technologist or the technician would be allowed to perform testing as defined by the body of knowledge requirements deemed appropriate by the nationally recognized certification agencies. This concept is already a core hiring practice that is followed by most healthcare employers in this state. Although the current version of this bill does not directly affect the scope of practice for cytotechnologists and histologists, the fact that it does contain language that dilutes the original intent of licensure and would allow non-certified personnel to perform highly complex medical testing, such as transfusion and genetics, is enough reason to warrant opposition to this bill. Our final concern is that many other states are considering laboratory licensure and are watching our state's licensure process and the language in this pending legislation. Given the complexity and ambiguity of this bill, we would not advocate using this bill as a model for licensure in other states. At the end of the day, our mission as medical laboratory professionals is to ensure the quality of medical laboratory testing in the state is effective, safe, and patient-centered. It is our position that this bill does not enhance that mission or support the original intent, and it is for all these reasons that the Minnesota Society of Cytology and our colleagues from the Minnesota Society of Histotechnology have chosen to actively oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to, reading through your document, and I understand maybe I just need to have some further explanation. You're talking about diluting the original intent of licensure. And you're making some references to sections in the bill, and I'm trying to track those, and maybe they're not quite synced up correctly. But can you just elaborate a little bit on that? When you say that the current version is a departure from the original intent and that it dilutes the desire to have high standards, how does that – just talk a little bit about that. I'm not sure if I'm following your argument.
Actually, if you look on page 12, section 9, I'm sorry, this is Lynette Savila from the MSC. If you look, 21, it starts at line 12.21, the medical laboratory subspecialists. In that section, it says under division 7, number 2, it has met required medical laboratory experience and training through 1 year of on-the-job training and either is deemed competent via written confirmation by the respective laboratory director or passes a nationally recognized certification examination administered by the NCA or the ASCP. Basically, what that's saying is that I don't necessarily have to be certified by an accrediting agency. My medical director can just decide if I'm competent enough and write it off. And that's one of the arguments that we have. That is a statement that's been put in and can be understood by some organizations that feel like this is a model that they need to have. But then what's the point of having a licensure bill that, in my opinion, puts a loophole in the bill? And And because when you look at the section that discusses education, they talk about how they're going to leave the education requirements to the accrediting agency. As Shelley said, these folks, if these folks go through that route to get their licensure, they won't be accredited. And there's nothing in this bill that explains then how our on-the-job trained folks going to fulfill CE or their continuing education requirements. It's not really clear. And I don't necessarily think that it was the intent of the coalition to, for lack of a better word, water down the bill, but I think that that's kind of how it's gotten at this point.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess to the points you're raising, how is that, is it a departure from current practice? I mean, how does this compare to what we do today? Is this an improvement, the same, or a lowering of the standards that exist today? What's the change?
In my opinion, it's the same. So we stated that we don't feel that this bill adds any additional value to the current practice in the state. As a hiring manager, I look for two pieces of information when an applicant comes to work in my laboratory, and they are that they have the education that they need to do the job, and number two, that they have the certification by a national agency. You know, one would argue, why have a national certification agency when you would only really need to allow 1 year of on-the-job training and a simple letter of recommendation? So we believe that is a deviation from the original intent of the licensure bill, which was to have two solid education and certification requirements. So the fact that certification is now an option, we feel that's a deviation from the original mission.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, you know, that change actually came about in our consultation with the Mayo Clinic. So, you know, your seatmate there might be able to fill you in a little more on the details that preceded that particular change.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, thank you. I guess that's part of what I was trying to get at is, you know, one way you could look at those provisions in the bill is an attempt to create some flexibility and some accommodation for practices that might not be allowable if you went to a strict licensure regimen. And wouldn't that be a good thing? I mean, isn't part of your concern that there's some rigidity in things, and if there's some allowance for, I guess, current practice, why wouldn't that be a good thing?
I don't necessarily know if by working on a job for 1 year, you're able to really have a full understanding of a body of knowledge that you're actually tested on in a national certification exam. I think that's the concern. You know, there is no definition within the bill that says what that person needs to accomplish in that 1 year of on-the-job training. There are no standards or sort of criterion for that 1 year. It's just 1 year of on-the-job training and a letter of recommendation. So I guess the ambiguity of what that means and the interpretation that could be open to would be dependent, you know, on the medical director that's signing off on that individual's competence.
And also, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand, in an executive summary that was given out by the coalition in January 2008, I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of that for you, but the purpose of the original bill, which was S-1830 and H-2109 of last year's session, was to provide protection to the public by requiring minimum qualifications of personnel. And with that addition, it doesn't necessarily set a minimum of qualification. And I guess, again, speaking personally, if we allow that type of flexibility, then why have a licensure bill at all? It feels like we could add that same amount of flexibility by, instead of having all those seven qualifications and all these exemptions and all these ifs, ands, ors, to have a bill that has two education requirements, an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, and certification, and allow time to get the certification, but get the certification. And I think that would help our colleagues that are sitting at the table with us as well.
Further questions? We do have one more witness who wanted to speak to the bill, Tamara Schwartz. Welcome to the committee.
I'm actually Ashley Wong. Tamara and I switched today, so okay. Hope that's not a problem. My name is Ashley Wong. I'm an embryology laboratory supervisor, and I received my technical supervisor certification through AAB, of which I'm a member in good standing. I've been working in the field of reproductive medicine for 10 years. I work at a small clinic in Woodbury, Minnesota. I have a bachelor's degree in science and a master's degree in science reproductive physiology. At my facility, we perform high complexity testing in andrology, chemistry, and hematology. I just wanted to apologize that we had to bring these opposition points at such a late hour, but we weren't consulted before Thursday, and so we had to kind of put this together shortly. I wanted to begin by thanking the committee for the opportunity to comment on this bill. While we believe the bill is a worthy effort towards this goal of providing physicians, healthcare practitioners, and patients with accurate, reliable, and reproducible testing results, we believe it does contain serious flaws that, if not addressed, could threaten to endanger patient health, safety, rather than protecting it. One of the first opposition points that I'd like to go through is the level of complexity of testing. Waived and moderately complex tests constitute the great majority of tests performed today, probably greater than 80% of the total tests. Yet the individuals performing these tests are exempt from the bill. And there's only one category that's not exempt, and that's the high complexity tests. The bill requires a bachelor's degree, no exceptions for the individuals who perform high complexity testing, and this is simply too restrictive. Rural hospitals often lack techs with BA degrees, so they would be prevented from conducting high complexity tests. This will delay diagnosis and treatment for patients in crisis, such as those poisoned by Salmonella, which can be detected only with a high complexity lab test. The major problem with the bill, in addition to exempting the testing with the highest error rates, is that many individuals who are well qualified to perform high complexity tests, including military trained veterans, are excluded from the technologist level licensure. I have a representative here from the VFW who opposes the bill, and the state commissioner could not be here today but does oppose the bill as well. The bill prohibits military trained techs from performing high complexity testing. It's bizarre to suggest that an active duty soldier in Afghanistan or Iraq can conduct a high complexity test for an injured soldier, but that same person should be prohibited from conducting the same test while working in a Minnesota hospital or clinic directly upon discharge. The bill does not recognize AAB Board of Registry certification examinations, which I'm here to tell you are really hard, as a leading national association that creates credentialing exams to determine professional proficiency. The exclusion of the AAB from the bill means that Minnesota lab techs currently credentialed by the AAB will lose their credentialed status and may lose their jobs. Only about 12 states currently license lab techs. Of those, about 6 require a BA degree for high complexity testing, but all recognize AAB national credentialing exam. Minnesota would be the only state to not recognize the AAB credentialing if this provision is not amended. AAB needs to be added to the bill. AAB is dedicated to serving the community clinical laboratory and the professionals involved in clinical laboratory operations. Founded in 1956, AAB members are clinical laboratory directors, owners, managers, supervisors, technologists, technicians, and phlebotomists. Many Minnesota lab techs are employed because they have successfully passed an AAB national credentialing examination. The AAB can support the bill if it is modified to allow persons without a BA to perform high-complexity lab testing, allow veterans to perform high-complexity lab testing, recognize the AAB's credentialing process, which is a national standard, and license all classes of lab techs, not just one. And finally, the cost of hiring technicians with a four-year degree for a small clinic like mine would change our salary, budget, and operating costs significantly. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from Ms. Wong? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to your last point, when you say significant, what do you mean by that? Is it just the additional expectation of someone with a four-year degree for salary that you would then have to meet if this became law?
Correct. And not only would that be applicable, but the staff might include or require to be competitive in the hiring market the licensing fees. After an employee has dedicated that 1 year of on-the-job training, it would not be inappropriate for that staff member then to ask the place of employment to pay for that licensing fee to work at that job. But the salary would be the biggest commitment from a small clinic. Right now, we only have 3 of 7 employees that would meet a BA requirement in our testing facility. So that would significantly change.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I think, 2-year degree people already do perform high complexity testing. I don't think that's in question. But, I think also federal regulation always trumps state regulation, as you and I know. So I don't think the veterans would not be, if they're working at a federal facility, they would not be under state law. They'd be under federal statute, of course. So, I don't think that would be an issue if that's what's being referred to.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up to your point about 2 out of 7. But is the grandfathering provisions, would your clinic still be able to function, or would you have to terminate the 5 employees who don't have this and hire new ones, or how would that work?
Well, even with the statute of being grandfathered in, they'd be grandfathered at this place of employment. But with their sometimes up to 25 years of experience, they would have to go through the licensure process to get another position. So even if they were grandfathered in under this clause, they would have to get that licensure, is my understanding, if they would change position. And also to address the point of the vets, vets do work in the private sector and in hospitals. So, yes, they would have that opportunity to be trumped by the federal statute, but unfortunately, if they decided to cross over to Minnesota, they would have to obtain that same.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hand, and to the witness again, I think the grandfather clause goes with the tech, not with the facility.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Kubley. I once again do appreciate the work that has been done on this issue in the last many, many months. And I, frankly, I think that's some of the flexibility, as Senator Hand pointed out, that is contained within the legislation before us today. I'm continuing to be just a little bit troubled in that, and I was appreciative of the work that the Minnesota Hospital Association put forward in terms of licensure, or to license or not to license. And I would just encourage stakeholders here and elsewhere, as they come forward with licensure bills, I think that it is really important that we are not licensing for licensing's sake, but that we are licensing to address some identified and unmet quality need or critical need, and just kind of a question that I have continues to be in my mind.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I guess you weren't here for my opening comments, but, if I can walk into a lab when the last time I worked in one was 15 years ago and be offered a job, even though I don't feel qualified, to me that's a problem.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. have a bizarre collection of things, so I apologize. I'll start with these. I got stuck looking at Section 15, which is grounds for disciplinary action. And I have to admit, I don't think I ever look at this section of licensure bills. But it, like 15.7, where we're saying that disciplinary action can be taken if somebody's got a petty misdemeanor. That seems a little odd to me. 15.12 violated the Code of Professional Conduct in subdivisions 2 to 4, which are duty to patient, duty to colleagues in profession, and duty to society. And I just can't remember ever seeing this kind of language before us before. And maybe Senate counsel can tell me if this is common or whether this is just seems as odd as it looks to me.
Senate counsel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, you're right, it is odd. In the amendment, we have cleaned up the duty to patient, duty to colleagues and profession, and we took out the duty to society.
Okay.
So I think that looks a little bit better. And we took most of that out because you're right. It is odd.
And then, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kavanaugh, can you, or maybe one of the testifiers, could you, somebody give me an example of the kind of crimes that are listed on 15.6 through 8? The difference, you know, the felony, the gross miss, the misdemeanor, and the petty misdemeanor, an essential element of which is dishonesty, or any crime directly related to the practice of this profession. Can somebody give me some examples of those types of levels of crimes?
Perhaps somebody from Department of Health here for that?
Maybe somebody. Anybody? Gee, everybody's so thrilled to come up to the table to answer this question.
Welcome to the committee. Did you hear the...
Senator Marty and Senator Higgins, I'm Tom Hendelmeyer from the Minnesota Department of Health. An example that comes to mind would be billing fraud in any significant amount that, based on the amount, would determine the level of violation.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hendelmeyer, what amount would trigger a petty misdemeanor? If you can just tell me that you don't know if you don't know, but you know, are we talking $100 or $50 or $500 or $2,000?
Senator Marty and Senator Higgins, I don't know. In terms of the exact amount there, I was thinking more in terms of the felony amount.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hendelmeyer, do you know the felony amount?
I thought it was several thousand dollars.
Several thousand. Mr. Chair, I mean, it's not my bill, and I have to admit I haven't been really involved with this, but this just seems a little I'm struggling with the right word. The disciplinary part of it just seems to be, maybe the word's overkill. Maybe that's the word I'm thinking of. And I'll just leave it at that. Then, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of, as you know, I do grammar and punctuation and spelling. On 12.29, can we put a period at the end of a sentence? And on 19.30, could we please put a period after the word late fee in bold?
Senator Higgins, could you, 12.29, period at the end of the sentence, and which other one?
19.30, there needs to be a period at the end of that subhead or whatever one would call
19.30.
it.
19.30, Senator Higgins moves to insert a period after first fee. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think Senator Higgins makes some good points. Do we have sections like this in all of our licensing bills? I'm sorry, I should know the answer to that. And maybe as an example, like on line 15.26, perform services for which the license is issued in an incompetent manner or in a manner that falls below community standards.
Mr. Handelmeyer again.
Senator Marty and Senator Lynch, could I ask you to repeat the question, please? I didn't hear it.
Mr. Chair, line 15.26, I was just providing further comment that I was supportive of Senator Higgins' remarks with regard to this overall section. And another example is on 15.27, in a manner that falls below community standards.
She wanted to know if that's standard in licensure laws.
Senator Marty and Senator Lynch, yes, it is. The issue is that it's impossible to define with precision in all circumstances what conduct would fall below an acceptable level of competence or skill. And so the reference to a community standard enables the decision maker to look at information and evidence from the community of practice as to what is an acceptable level in terms of determining competence and skill.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Kubli, I wanted to go back to the point that Senator Lynch had raised a few minutes ago, and I'm looking at a document provided by the Minnesota Hospital Association for us that sort of a general comment on various licensure bills. And on this particular one, they comment that there have been changes that address what they call their technical concerns, but then they say they have a philosophical concern, and they say that they generally oppose adding licensure requirements unless there is evidence that those working in the field pose a safety or quality threat. And while they understand that lab professionals wish to be licensed, they do not believe they pose a quality or safety threat to the public. And I guess I'm just curious if there's anybody from the Hospital Association that could explain what they mean by that, because some of the testimony that you're bringing, Senator Kubli, would suggest the opposite of that, and I just would be curious to know the other side of that.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that document. I wonder if you could provide that.
Stout, you want to comment?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sue Stout. I'm a lobbyist with the Minnesota Hospital Association. The comment in our letter has to do with the principles that we put forward with our committee. And essentially what our internal committee said was, unless they believe there's some kind of a threat to the public, they question the need to move forward. And at the time that we reviewed this, we hadn't seen any threat. We weren't aware of a threat to the public. We haven't been getting lots of calls about the lab professionals doing a bad job. And so our analysis was that they don't pose a threat. We did work with them on a number of technical changes to the bill, and they very much accommodated those changes. But this goes more to kind of the philosophy behind why we're doing licensure to begin with. And I think that I should say that probably the reason that we even wrote a letter like this year has a lot to do with the number of licensure bills that are before us and this general feeling that we have that there's just one on top of another on top of another, and we begin to wonder about inside the hospital whether we're cutting up the work into too many tiny pieces and adding to the cost of health care. But that's a general philosophical approach. I mean, if the committee were to do the lab licensure bill and not any others, that would be great. We just think that we're just on a slippery slope.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Stout. I appreciate your comment. I guess I'm curious to know, though, when you say that you don't believe there's a quality or safety threat, is that because the work itself, in theory, is incapable of posing a quality or safety threat, or there just have not been documented instances, lawsuits or harm to the public? Or could you just explain a little bit more when you say that? Are you talking about just haven't been any problems, even though there potentially could be, or that just there isn't really much of a potential for problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, the latter, not the former.
Okay.
It's not that there's not a potential for errors. I think everything you do in a hospital, in every level of work, there's always potential for errors. But we're just not aware of this being a problematic professional group. It isn't that our phone's been ringing off the hook going, oh, my goodness, you have some really bad lab professionals out there.
And Mr. Chairman.
Sir Hand.
Thank you. And Ms. Stout, just one, I guess, final comment then is part of your concern related to, you talked about dividing up the work and having multiple licensures. Is this a contributing factor to cost? I mean, we had some discussion about this previously, and I just wanted to know if your association has a perspective on this. If we go down the path of licensing every job and doing it in a very fine way, does that add cost to the system as a whole, in your judgment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, we believe that does add to cost, to especially taken to its extreme. When you license every group, and you know there's a list here, but there's more bills to come, I guarantee you, yet this session on other groups, eventually you end up in a situation where you can't cross train. You have to have, well, I don't mean to be unkind, but you can't have somebody come into the room to do something because that's kind of like not my section. That's not my work. You have to get this person to do that work, and it kind of cuts up all the work. It actually adds to the potential for discoordination as well.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn. I actually have an email here to Mr. Panning from Lawrence Massa, who is the new president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, stating that they will not oppose this bill.
Senator Hahn.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Kubley, I appreciate that. And I guess I'm wrestling with this. I know we had this last year, and I appreciate you've gone through some effort, clearly, to try to make this more palatable. But I am really struggling with this a little bit because I guess I share some of the philosophical concerns that Ms. Stout raised, that what happens if you do all the licensing that we're calling for potentially and you don't have the right mix of people available at the right time, and then something is needed to be done and then it just can't be done. As the wording in the 214 document said, you just shut down the service. And so it would seem to me that it would be an advantage to the medical system to have some flexibility to allow things to be done without being restricted by over-aggressive licensure practices, and particularly if there's no discernible threat to the safety of the public, why wouldn't we want to encourage the kind of the let's do the right thing and try to solve the problem that we have in the best way we can and at the most efficient cost we can? And I'm not sure that the licensing push is moving in that direction, but maybe the other way. And I don't know if you have a comment on that, but I'm struggling with this a little bit.
Anybody, Senator Kubli, did you want to comment? Or Senator, Ms. Stout?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, and I think to Senator Kubli's comment, we're not here to say don't do anything with lab professionals. But we are here to just throw up a bit of a red flag about kind of the path that we're moving down with all this licensure. And so I'm not going to say that absolutely lab professionals, no. But we do want to throw up a bit of a red flag for you to think about in terms of just the sheer numbers and cutting up of the healthcare workforce and where that can lead us.
And in a few weeks, we are going to be having an overview of Chapter 214 and the whole licensure issue, because we have had, I think there are a number of bills rumbling below the surface that haven't been introduced yet for licensure too. So we will be doing that, I think, around the time of after the deadline. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Stout, my understanding, based on a presentation that I went to this summer, which was a national presentation, so that's why I'm asking if we follow that pattern here. But my understanding is that people who are hired to work in labs who are not licensed or may not meet a certain level of licensure standard are sometimes given on-the-job training, and they are trained, you know, very incrementally. So they don't do something they haven't been trained for, but they are trained to do something, and they do that for a while, and if they do that well, then they're trained to do something else, and that the person in charge of the entire lab makes sure that the people that are working there are not doing tasks that they're not properly trained for. Is that the way it works here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's my understanding of how it works, but there's probably other people here that could answer that better than I could.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, obviously there's a lot of us here in laboratory profession here today, and yet because of the regulations that are placed on us because of the CLIA regulation, for all medical laboratory professionals, it is the medical director's responsibility to make sure that all of the medical professionals performing medical testing underneath their license are competently trained, and that's all in the CLIA regulations.
It's right over here. Senator, does anyone have a motion? Or Senator Brittner-Solon?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we've debated, and I would like to move the bill at this time.
Senator Prettner-Solon moves Senate File 999 as amended. Is this bill going
in? Does it need to go in the House? Where's it going to go, Mr. Chairman?
Nobody else has requested
it. Well, it has to go to Finance.
It's got an advisory council?
Yeah. It's got to go to State and Local.
I don't know if it goes anywhere before then, but it has to go to Finance. It's got fees in it.
State and Local.
State and Local government, because
advisory
it's got an advisory council.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, before we move the bill.
Senator Higgins.
On 15.7, can we take out the petty misdemeanor? That still bugs me. I'll move to delete. Let's see, on 15.6, at the end of the line, put the word or. And on 15.7, delete comma or petty misdemeanor.
On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. So on Senator Prettner-Solon's motion that Senate File 999 is amended to be recommended or passed and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Division. All those in favor, raise your hands. All those opposed? By a 6-5 motion, the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Kubley. Senator Prettner Solon.
This is the only bill I've been waiting for. It's the body art.
Body art. I know my body art. I don't know if I'm going to watch it.
They're regulating.
Mr. Chair, may I take the second bill first? I think it's quick, simple.
Yes, go ahead and take the second one first if you wish, so we can. Senate file 545. I think this is a fairly quick one.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I do have an author's amendment. It's the A2 amendment.
Senator Prettner Solon moves the A2 amendment to Senate file 545. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate file 545 is a bill that seeks to further define psychologists' current practices and activities. As discussions continue about health care reform with related evolving responsibilities for health care professionals, psychologists believe an important step is to assure that current practice is well documented. This legislation has several parts. The first section codifies that psychologists' appeals to health plans for a denial of a psychological service receive peer review. Currently, the final denial must receive a pro forma review by a psychiatrist. The second asks that a psychologist be added to the Health Care Reform Review Council, reflecting the indivisibility of mental health and physical health and the important role psychologists play in our health care system. And then the third section reflects the common and longstanding practice for psychologists of discussing with clients what medications they are taking, the dosage, and what sort of effects they are experiencing as a consequence of the medication. Psychologists may subsequently discuss this information provided with the client, provided by the client with the prescriber or in a report. And it is important to keep in mind that this in no way expands the scope of practice for psychologists, nor is it related to prescriptive privileges for psychologists. And then there were a couple of sections that were removed, section 4-9. Today with me is Dr. Steve Vincent, who is the legislative committee chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association. He will add some comments on why the legislation is needed and is available to answer any questions the committee may have. And I might add, too, that we had a meeting this morning with Pauline Walker Singleton and some of the staff from the Minnesota Board of Psychology. They are voicing no objection to this bill. And also Dominic Spazzetto, I think, is here in the audience representing the psychiatrists, and they also do not object to the bill. And so Dr. Steve Vincent.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Steve Vincent, and I'm a psychologist who lives in St. Cloud, and I have practiced there for 31 years at St. Cloud Hospital in the Centric Care Health System. And I'm a member of the Governing Council of the Minnesota Psychological Association. We call it MPA. And I'm also chair of the Legislative Committee. And I'm here to testify in support of this bill. Senator Prettner Solon has summarized the bill very well. And I, for sake of your time and the time of everybody else who's trying to get into this room later, I won't reiterate all that. The bill is not controversial, but it is important because it specifies what psychologists are able to do consistent with practice and clarifies some of those matters now, namely being able to review one another's services for determination of clinical necessity, being able to contribute to the Healthcare Reform Council with the special expertise in mental health, and being able to discuss medications. Not prescribe. Let me be very clear about that. Not prescribe. Discuss medications with patients and clients, because that is an integral part of the practice of psychology. So thank you. I really don't need to say a lot more, and I can entertain any questions that any committee member has.
Thank you, Dr. Vincent. The bill would be slightly more controversial if they were prescribed.
Yes, that's well recognized.
There are questions from the committee. Is there anybody in the audience? Senator Berglund.
Well, I just have one comment, Senator Prettner-Solon, and that is in regard to Section 2, Subdivision 2 of the bill. You know, this group doesn't really have any advisory authority even. It is a group that receives reports, and anybody can go to the meeting who wants to. And so if we start doing this and adding each group that exists, we're going to probably make our statute books longer by about 5 pages, unnecessarily, in my opinion. This is not a working group. This is just a group that receives updates, and their public meetings, any group can go to the public meeting who wants to.
Senator, may I respond? Senator Marty, Senator Berglund. I recognize that most of the work of the goes on in working groups, and that this review council is there just to receive the reports of those. However, I think it's really important to have a mental health professional on that review council because of the increasing recognition of the importance of integration of mental health and medical general health care services, and that's what this provision would accomplish.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's nothing that says that one of the groups listed in the statute already couldn't appoint a mental health professional.
Yes, that's true, but there's also, from reviewing that group, not much likelihood, I think, Senator, that a mental health professional would be appointed given the members of those groups. And because mental health is such an important part of health, and because it's such an important part of health prevention or disease prevention, health maintenance, I believe, and Minnesota Psychological Association believes, the citizens would be well served by having a mental health professional on the review council.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll just make one more comment and then I'll be done with it. But, you know, the same argument could be made by the Dental Association. The same argument could be made by the Physical Therapy Association. I mean, the list of people that are very important to our healthcare delivery system goes on and on and on, and yet, you know, at some point, just adding all these groups of people to this body that really is not an action-oriented body seems to me to be somewhat counterproductive.
Further discussion on the bill. Is there anyone who wanted to testify with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Prettner-Solon moves that Senate File 545 be recommended to pass as amended. And I was told, who is the floor now? State and local?
Yes.
That's a big adding.
Because of that provision. Senator Prettner-Solon moves Senate File 545 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
It's 2-0.
Senate File 525.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 525. This is a bill that was before the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee last March, and the bill was passed out of committee, but due to tight committee deadlines, we did not have time to get through the various stops this bill had to make. Both Judiciary and Commerce have requested to see the bill, and it is my hope that we will move it quickly through the committee process. Tattooing is one of the fastest-growing industries in the United States today. One successful tattooist could tattoo perhaps hundreds or thousands of people every year. Each of these people who receive a tattoo make a common assumption, and that is that the tattoo they receive is safe. A study released in July of 2003 by Scripps Howard News Service and Ohio University
claims that 1 in 7 adults has a tattoo, and 88% personally know at least one person who has a tattoo. Additionally, 30% of those in the 25 to 34 year age group and 28% of those under 25 are tattooed. These numbers show that tattooing is not a passing fad. It is on weekly television shows and is a multi-billion dollar industry. Yet in Minnesota, there is no regulation regarding the application of tattooing, the licensure of tattoo artists, the inspection of tattoo shops, or recourse against unethical operators. Possible side effects of a suboptimal tattoo procedure include antibiotic-resistant staph infection and hepatitis C. In Minnesota, there are regulations and licensing for haircutting. There are regulations and licensing for massage. Tattooing, however, which comes into contact with biohazardous material, has no standard regulation or licensing in Minnesota. I have a couple of people here today with me who have worked in the tattoo industry in Minnesota. Joseph Trowbridge is the owner of Anchors and Tattoo Shop in Duluth, and Ryan Wells has been an advocate for the past few years for tattoo application regulation in Minnesota. Using models such as Oregon's state tattoo regulation and Minnesota's Hennepin County regulation, these tattooists and others have worked to create a state regulation that protects artists and clients. And Senate File 525 only has a few changes from the bill this committee passed last year. The committee last year had recommendations on how to grandfather in the first round of licensed body artists. We worked with Senate Counsel to insert language that would exempt body artists from the supervised training requirement until January 1st of 2011 if they are able to provide evidence to the commissioner that they have had at least 200 hours performing body art procedures within the past 5 years. That change can be found on page 6, line 32, and an effective date has also been included in this year's bill of August 1st, 2010. As leaders in their field, these advocates are asking for a responsible state policy of licensure and regulation. This is an opportunity for the state legislature to work with the tattoo industry proactively. And I might also add that there are several people here to testify in support. One of them is the Blood Banks and the Red Cross, who recognize that people who have been punctured and they're not sure whether they've been sterile needles are not able to donate blood for at least a year after that puncture. If there were regulations in place that assured the safety of those needles, that would allow more people to donate to the blood bank. It was possible in the past. And now I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Wells, who will be able to answer any questions, and I believe he's going to walk through the provisions of the bill.
And
also,
Senator Prettner, so when Senate Counsel points out that on page 5, line 33, you have the licensure effective January of 2010, and the bill itself doesn't take place till August 2010, did you mean January 2011 it takes effect on page 5?
It should be 09.
Or did you want the bill to take effect August 1st of this year?
Do you want to respond to that?
I believe that was...
You need to identify yourself.
Excuse me, Chairman. My name is Joseph Trowbridge. I believe that 2011 date was for the people that would be grandfathered in. After the bill was...
So we've got a question. The bill is worded. Section 3 says licensure is required by January 2010, and the bill is not scheduled to take effect until August of 2010. So we want to know what your intent is, whether you want it licensure to begin.
Does it be in January or...
You want the bill to be effective this year,
yes,
and licensure 2010?
Yes.
You're saying August of 2010.
The August bill is 2009.
The bill you want effective August of this year instead of August of next year?
Yes. You want
right now your effective date is... Yes.
Okay, August 2009.
Yes. Okay, yes.
So both of these dates would have to be changed.
No,
you don't want to change
this. Just the one at the
okay.
end.
So Senator Prettner Solon moves page 16, line 2, to delete 2010 and insert 2009. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. go ahead.
Mr. Chair, there is other language in here that Hennepin County brought to our attention that needs to be changed, and we're not certain about what specific language should be used at this point, so it does need to make a stop in judiciary. I think that would be the appropriate place to look at that. We do not want to preempt Hennepin County's legislation, and I think it requires only the addition of a couple words that say and county or otherwise changing municipal to local. We're not certain what is the appropriate language at this time. And
Senate Council has language, I think, if you want it now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prittner-Solon, do you want to wait till judiciary, or do you want to go ahead and add county where we previously asked or talked about?
I think that would be okay.
Senator Prittner-Solon moves then that page
13. Page 13, line 25, add comma county. And
after state,
and on lines 26, after state, insert comma county comma, and then on page 15, on line 23, after any, insert county or.
What was the second one, Ms. Cavender?
Page 15, line 23, after any, insert county or.
We have to change it in the title, too.
And on the head note, too?
On line 22 in the title, county and municipal regulations.
Regulations. Senator Prittner-Solon moves that. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Your witnesses.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators. I'm Ryan Wells, former employee of Anchors and Tattoo. This bill has been heard here before, and I'd be happy to walk through it again. Basically, the sections of the bill include definitions, facility requirements, technician requirements, apprenticeship requirements, and operation, records keeping, and enforcement. So any specific questions on any of those, I'd be happy to answer. Other than that, our concern for this bill was that the counties in Minnesota and the cities that are regulated have the tendency to push operators who are suboptimal to the counties that are not regulated. So the question right now isn't do I prefer this tattooist art or that tattooist art, but am I going to get hepatitis or not? And that's something that we'd like to prevent. Senator Lynch mentioned earlier not licensing for licensing alone. And excuse me. That's some excellent work there, Senator Marty. But whether or not this is an unmet need in our community, the amount of people tattooed in Minnesota and the amount of contact that people have with biohazardous material completely unregulated in our county is a touch distressing to us. Does anybody have any questions for me?
Questions from the committee. Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you had the sideburns last year. I don't recall that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I may or may not have. I do not recall.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Trowbridge.
Yes, Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions.
You don't have any testimony. You just were there for questions.
Okay. Yes.
We do have several other witnesses. Dwayne Holt, Jed Gorlin, and Jeff Kaufman.
Mr. Chair, Dwayne Holt will not be making it today.
Okay. Jed Gorlin from Memorial Blood Centers and Jeff Kaufman from Red Cross. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jed Gorlin, Medical Director, Memorial Blood Centers. Memorial Blood Center has been proud to serve the state of Minnesota for over 60 years, providing over 130,000 whole blood collections, 14,000 apheresis platelets to over 30 hospitals throughout the metro area and all the hospitals from Duluth up to International Falls. Fear not, this is not a step to put Minnesota out on a limb. Simply put, approving this legislation puts us in step with the almost 50% of states that already have such legislation. We support this legislation for two public health reasons. One, as you've heard, we have a pretty good track record on prevention of hepatitis transmissions, but by passing this legislation, it helps ensure that minimal transmission with the expanding practice. But second is very specific to our blood centers in that we are obliged to follow national regulations, and I happen to have had the honor of serving as the chair of the standards committee that sets those regulations, and quite specifically, the ABB donor eligibility for blood donation requires a one-year deferral for non-sterile skin penetration with instruments or equipment contaminated with blood or body fluids other than the donor's own. This includes tattoos or permanent makeup unless applied by a state-regulated entity with sterile needles and ink that has not been reused. So by passing this legislation, it makes us not have to defer donors. And alas, a donor once deferred is far less likely to return. With increasing numbers of high school and college students getting tattoos, the future blood donor population is directly affected. So we approve this legislation, and I thank you for your opportunity for this testimony.
Thank you. Dr. Gorland, if somebody gets a tattoo and there's a, not blood poisoning, I suppose, but they have some sort of infection, so after a year it's cleared up? I mean, it's not a persistent thing usually?
Actually, our testing, which is uniform across all blood centers, is incredibly sensitive, and it screens for hepatitis B, C, and HIV, both by molecular techniques, polymerase chain reaction, and antibody techniques. You actually turn antibody positive for most of those within 6 months, and the molecular screen ought to be positive within months. So the 12 months is really something of an overkill, but that happens to be the historic FDA regulation.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Oh, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, there's a section of this bill that requires an operator to report any possible transmission of a bloodborne pathogen to the Department of Health. Is the idea then that the Department of Health would notify you of that person and then you would have them on a list so you would know that they shouldn't be donating?
Dr. Hindlemeyer, I think, can probably comment, but that is not, in fact, the way things work in this state. If we do detect a positive, we report to the State Department of Health, but actually not the other way around.
But that's not what's in the bill. What's in the bill says that a licensed facility doing a tattoo, if they believe there's been transmission of a bloodborne pathogen during that tattooing act, has to report it to the Commissioner of Health.
So, Senator Berglund, so they're reporting to the people in this bill are reporting to the Department of Health.
Yes.
And the blood banks are reporting to the Department of Health. You're just saying, you can go to the Department of Health for records on that, or that's private data.
So I'm just trying to figure out what the Department of Health does with that then.
It's on page you may be called on in a minute again if you will.
Senator Berglund, what section are you looking
at? It's on page 13, line 28, it begins.
Hepatitis B, C, and HIV are reportable diseases to the State Department of Health. And followed nationally by the CDC. The Department of Health has procedures for tracking down any cases of transmission and would be doing investigations. Rich Danila of State Department of Health could comment more over that.
Mr. Chair, may I respond a little bit to Senator Berglund? I'm not sure if this is helpful, but this the section you're talking about refers to a needle stick to an operator who has been working on a patient. And the same is true if there is a similar incident in a hospital or a clinic when a practitioner is stuck with a needle in which they've been working on a that has been used on a patient that needs to be reported to the Department of Health.
Mr. Chairman, so do we know what the Department of Health does with it?
No.
Nobody knows. Okay.
Welcome back to the committee.
That's not what this says.
Senator Marty and Senator Berglund, Tom Hendelmeyer from the Health Department again. It's been decades since I dealt with the epidemiology section of the department, but my recollection is that there is a surveillance system for the reporting of certain contagious diseases. It is connected with the Centers for Disease Control, and the department tracks them, and in the case of life-threatening illnesses, they may do notification of sexual partners, other certain caregivers, where it's necessary to protect the health and safety of persons associated with the individual that has the pathogen. And as Dr. Gorlin mentioned, the data is private.
So it's obviously not a check and balance for the blood banks, but they have plenty of their own. Okay. And this was the needle stick of the provider, not of the tattoo artist, not the needle stick of the potential blood donor.
Correct.
Mr. Kaufman, welcome to the committee. No,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, excuse me, my name is Jeff Kaufman. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the North Central Blood Services Region of the American Red Cross. And the American Red Cross does support Senate File 525 regulating body art establishments and technicians. In order to reduce the risk of virus transmission from donor to recipient, the Red Cross follows the AABB standards, as does Memorial, as Dr. Gorlin indicated, for deferring persons who receive tattoo or a piercing other than within the ear within a 12-month period of time. And that 12-month period of time is one that we would like to eliminate, if at all possible, through this legislation. It allows more donors to be able to donate blood in a much more timely fashion. Senate File 525 requires that tattoo and piercing facilities fulfill health and safety requirements, such as the sterilization and sanitation techniques, and completing a course on blood-borne pathogens like the one that we offer at the Red Cross. We've been serving this community in a similar fashion for 60 years. We serve about 112 hospitals in Minnesota, western Wisconsin, and eastern South Dakota by providing blood products and specialized lab services. And we believe that Senate File 525 has a positive effect, or will have a positive effect, on all residents of the state of Minnesota who want to donate blood for a patient in need or who may one day need a life-saving blood transfusion of their own. And we do cover the state of Minnesota, and we strongly support Senate File 525. And we also wanted to acknowledge your support and passage of the 16-year-old blood center bill last year. You should know that that experience has been a great one for us and for those 16-year-old donors. This bill before you will also enhance our donor base in a very safe and health-acceptable way. Thank you.
Just a curiosity of the donor demographics, are there more young people or more older folks who are donating blood, percentage of population?
Right now it's more older people, but some of the reasons for deferral in the younger population have been tattoos and piercing. We'd like to remove that.
Are there further questions from the committee? Is there anybody who wanted to testify with concerns about the bill? Not. Senator Pretner Solan moves Senate File 525 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And with that, the business of the day is done. The committee's adjourned.